fellas want to read me my rights.
You have the right to have your face kicked in by me. You have the right to have your balls stomped by him.
I'll waive my rights.
They're pretty simple. The forms are all standard, boilerplate.
Okay, well, we're all hungry. We're gonna get to our hot plate soon enough, all right? But let's talk about the contract here.
Sorry.
You'd be surprised how many doors a letter from a lawyer can open or close.
It seems like you're talking slower since you started charging by the hour.
What's the meaning of this? This is my quiet time.
We're gonna have to take you into custody.
That's outrageous. What am I charged with?
Don't have to tell you anymore. Clearly haven't been reading your Scalia.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 199. Wow, we're almost done, Andrew. We just have a 200 episode contract, yeah. So.
Yeah, there are 200 questions on the multi-state portion of the bar exam, and that's it. We're done. So everybody, turn off the lights.
Did we not mention? We must have mentioned the fact that we're ending it after 200. Did we not mention that? Okay, well. I guess that's an oversight on our part, but now you know. Two more episodes here. No, just kidding. We're going to do it.
This is great. After as well as our April Fool's joke was received, I mean, I think I got literal death threats on that one.
There's going to be people who stop the podcast right away and just like went to the typewriter to send us
an angry email. Yeah. If you want to save opening arguments, the opening argument. Yeah. No,
we're fine.
We're not in it. We love the show.
It's the best. There's so much work yet to be done forever, seemingly.
Yes.
And we got a great show today. Lots of interesting things, including secret audio tapes in which Republicans confess exactly what we all knew they were thinking the entire time. Is fair summary, you'd say?
Yes.
And we're going to talk about asbestos. Which I'm hoping this is just a historical deep dive, right? This is going to be just looking back.
Oh no!
At the because that's all over with. There's no right. I mean, I see asbestos on the plan here, but surely this must be a deep dive history into an old topic. So we'll look at that, and then we've got a great listener question. So that's our show. Can't wait to do it. Any announcements from you over there?
Nope. Let's get into it.
All right.
Political.
Let's get into political. So, yes, Devin Nunes. Oh, man.
Oh, this guy.
Tell us about Devin Nunes.
Yeah. So, I grew up late 80s, early 90s, foray into politics, and the TRB, the anonymous commentator at the New Republic before it became a neoconservative rag, was Michael Kinsley. He used to be on Crossfire. He was a really, really formative pundit when I was a kid. Preteen and then teenager, and he shaped a lot of my views on politics. And he defined a political gaffe as not when a politician lies, but when he accidentally tells the truth. And it's good to know, right? Like
I'm reviewing in my mind something Hillary said about deplorables. Yeah, okay, check. Accidentally told the truth. Okay.
Yeah, it applies to everybody except Donald Trump.
Right.
So it's good to know that the Kinsley definition of gaffe is alive and well. Devin Nunes, is it Nunes?
Oh, crap. I can't remember. Nunes. Yeah, I don't know. Sorry. Did I say the wrong thing? Person listening, email us on our pronunciation of that'll straighten it out.
I am not doing it. Andrew was wrong. I would view that as Nunez, but
it's not Nunez. I know for sure it's not Nunez.
It's Olathe. It's Devin Olathe. Olathe.
Devin Olathe.
All right.
Good one.
So here he is. He is at a closed door. fundraiser for Republican House candidates. And these tapes have been leaked first, I believe, on the Rachel Maddow show. They're sort of parceling them out over time. And now the audio is out. There's pretty easy to find.
So Brian's going to play you guys a little clip of Devin, whatever his name, Devin Olathe Nunes, with a gaffe of him telling the truth. So here, let's take a listen to that.
So therein lies, so it's like your classic catch-22 situation, where, I mean, we're at a, this what puts us in such a tough spot. If Sessions won't unrecuse and Mueller won't clear the president, we're the only ones, which is really the danger. That's why I keep, and I'm thanking you for saying it, by the way.
We have to keep all these seats. We have to keep the majority. If we do not keep the majority, all of this goes away. So
yes, that's about what we expected. Every Republican was thinking, right?
Yeah. And I cannot but imagine that in targeted ads, this quote and others like it are going to make a number of featuring appearances, down as we move towards the midterm elections. This, is really going to energize Democrats. I see it as disproportionately energizing Democrats to vote for the same reason, right, that we're consistently trying to, keep up spirits around here, right? Like, hey, let's fight a holding action is not nearly as motivating as, hey, let's change things. Let's make things for the better. And having, a high profile Republican congressman who says that Rod Rosenstein should be impeached, having, and that's the, that's the next portion, right? Like having that person concede so openly to his donors, look, this is what voting Republican is about. And so if you don't support Donald Trump, and, again, Donald Trump is high 30s, low 40s. This is a pretty safe message to run on virtually everywhere. If you don't support Donald Trump, electing this guy, no matter how reasonable he sounds, is a vote to protect Donald Trump. Just listen to what their top strategists say when they're behind closed doors and they think you're not paying attention. That's a really, really tough message to counter. And it's a tough message to counter because it's true. Yeah. Right. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm glad it's so nice to hear. It's like we've all been being gaslit for a while. And it's nice to hear like, wait, no, we knew it. We knew you all knew you were getting away with murder. You Republicans. We knew you because they do such a good job of like just they're incredible at it. Like just, oh, I don't know what you're talking about. Why would we ever just impeach? What? What has Trump done that's worthy? And then behind closed doors, like, guys, we're hanging on by a thread. this thing's unraveling. Like, you just keep us in here, and we'll keep this this president who clearly should have been impeached. So yeah, it's nice to know we're not all crazy.
And that's the second half of that, right? In which Nunez assures his donors, hey, look, we'd all love to impeach Rod Rosenstein, but if we do that, that's going to slow down the Senate and it's going to delay the Kavanaugh nomination. And he doesn't say this, but implicit in there is the idea that Republicans are concerned that the Democrats could retake the Senate, right? I mean, because that's the only reason you have to cram through the Kavanaugh nomination right now is if you're worried that holding it out might, potentially give you, a redo of the Mitch McConnell, Merrick Garland situation. So that's what the other side is thinking. And that's why I thought that was a good insight. We continue to, look for if you are joining us kind of left of center, there's not a lot of good news every week. But, when your opponents start saying stuff like this, that's good news. And for a second helping of that with respect to the future of the Congress is the indictment of Chris Collins, Republican from a conservative district in upstate New York, the 27th Congressional District. This is a PVI plus
Chris Collinsworth was indicted. I will not hear it. He's...
Oh, gosh. Chris Collinsworth should be indicted for crimes against humanity. No, but
now we're going to have another fight here because I love Chris Collinsworth as a football commentator.
Are you kidding? Oh, he's the best. All right. Well, we will do that. I am sure episode. You and I talking about... you know, the NFL announcing is going to get just as much love as our Democratic fantasy football draft.
Well, that and baseball. So we're not talking about Chris Collinsworth. Yep. We're talking about another wide receiver from the Senate. Who's Chris Collins?
Yeah,
tell me who this is.
We're talking about Congressman Chris Collins. So I want to briefly go through the story because this guy is a dissembler of the first rank, right? He is deliberately saying things that are designed to give a misleading impression about why he was indicted and what the factual issues are. And it's so bad that his lies are documented in the indictment itself. And so they're going to continue. So let's talk about Collins really quickly. He owned 17% of a biotech startup called Immunotherapeutics, which is based in Sydney, Australia. And they were developing a drug called MIS-416 that was designed to treat multiple sclerosis. So it was in trials. And a little over a month ago, it failed the trial. Now, when that happens, that renders that company's tech stock, which has a bit of a bubble floating on it, right, virtually worthless, right? Like the companies get bought up and are speculative. And the moment at which the trial comes in, either your speculation pays off and it goes up some more, or everybody says, oh, look, like we thought this might be, you know, a useful therapeutic drug with respect to MS patients. Turns out it isn't. Time to dump this stock and get out, you know, while the going's bad, but before it goes to zero. And in fact,
so what you're saying is it's a real insider trading opportunity.
Yeah. And let me put some numbers on it. The day after the failure became public, Immunotherapeutics Limited dropped 92%. Right?
Wow.
So, I mean, I am not exaggerating. It is the difference between holding, you know, US currency and Confederate currency. Right. So, here's the biggest thing as we dive into the complaint. There is no allegation by the government that Collins traded his stock, right? And this is crucial because all of his defense is, well, I didn't trade any of my stock. The complaint itself knows, right? This is paragraph 24. I'm going to link it. It says, I mean, you know, Collins' dissembling is so obvious on this that the indictment itself says, as he, Collins, well knew, he was virtually precluded from trading his own shares for practical and technical reasons. First, he was already under investigation by the Office of Congressional Ethics for his holdings and was recently interviewed by the OCE. And second, his shares were subject to a legal hold in Australia, so they could not be accessed by a U.S. broker. So every time you see Collins in the news say, witch hunt, fake news. Well, no, sorry, he didn't use that language. But every time you see Collins say, this is ridiculous, I didn't trade any shares, the government doesn't allege that he trades any shares. And in fact, they allege that he is going around saying, I didn't trade any shares, as part of the conspiracy to hide the fact that what he did was tip off his son, his daughter-in-law, his daughter-in-law's father, and unnamed friends who traded their shares. And let's talk about that, because this is on the level of the Manafort indictment. So here's the timeline. June 22nd, 2017, the CEO of Immunotherapeutics sends out a blast email to the majority shareholders saying that the drug failed the protocol. At 7:10 p.m. Eastern Time, Collins sends back an email that says, wow, that makes no sense. How are these results even possible? Okay. Then he calls his son at 7:11, right? Fewer than 60 seconds after hitting send on his email. He calls at 7:11 and 23 seconds, gets no answer again. Then he calls back at 7:14. And then it's 7:14 and 51 seconds. And then it's 7:15 and 27 seconds. And then it's 7:15 and 50 seconds. After he has 6 missed calls in 5 minutes, he finally gets a hold of his son at 7:16 p.m. And the allegation is that he told his son, hey, they failed the protocol. Dump your stocks.
Man, if I ever want to do any insider trading, I better make sure to turn my phone on because I just don't. Mine's been on mute for 5 years. And that you could just call forever and it would never do anything. So note to self, if you're ever going
to
engage.
As somebody who has tried to call you, I can vouch for that.
Sometimes I see it. Like sometimes I'm already looking at my phone and then I'm like, oh, a phone call. I forgot it could do that. I didn't even know phones did that. Anyway.
There's this weird capacity for it to carry audio over that. Look, like a jury, the dumbest, most biased, the worst jury on earth is going to go, I wonder why 60 seconds after finding out that the company failed its drug protocol, he turned around and called his son 7 times in a row until he picked up the phone. And then obviously this is 7:16 p.m. U.S. markets are closed. Will it surprise you to learn that his son, Cameron Collins, dumps 1.4 million shares of stock the next day, actually over a period of days, because there's an embargo on the release of the information. But over the next 3 days, Cameron Collins dumps 1.4 million shares of stock and passes on the information to the rest of the family members. And, you know, and it goes through and lists, the extensive trading back and forth. Now, some of these family members only dumped, a couple of $100 worth of stock because that's all they owned. Right. They bought in. They were speculative. And he was like, OK, time to get out before we lose any money. Don't take legal advice from a podcast or anything. But if you only own $680 of a
maybe
stock,
maybe take that loss. Maybe go ahead and take a
$680. Yeah.
Is it worth ask yourself the $670 that you would recover to risk being investigated and going to prison?
Yeah. If I were to ask, I mean, this is the economic calculus I would do, which is if I were under investigation for illegal trading, how much would I pay to not be under investigation for illegal trading?
Yeah.
And the answer is considerably higher than $680. This is a thought experiment and is not intended as legal advice for any of our insider traders. So Chris Collins has been indicted under the appropriate regulations, which is 17 CFR 240.10B5. This is called a 10B5 action. And he is charged with conspiracy. Again, what we have is the indictment. Is it possible that the facts are otherwise? I suppose so. But given the way Collins has spoken about this publicly, it sure doesn't look like it. It looks like he is deliberately being evasive and trying to take advantage of the fact that, that it can be confusing to figure out insider trade. You know, people think insider trading and they think, oh, I got tipped off, so I sold. It's not that hard to explain. Oh, I got tipped off. I couldn't sell because I was already under investigation and my shares were restricted by the government of Australia. So I told all my friends and family to sell.
It seems like an easy case to make.
I don't think that's going
to
be difficult. Yeah. So keep that in mind. That's the case against Collins. You're going to see him in the news. He looks like a scumbag. And again, we would say this if this were a Democrat. There certainly have been Democrats who have engaged in insider trading. This is not, this is a both sides do it. This is a story out there. And obviously.
And on that note, gosh, what was it, last week or something? I saw something where I think part of the Republicans were trying to talk about the fact that there were some, maybe Bernie's campaign manager guy or some other Democrats might be swept up in this whole investigation. Might be. And my thought was, well, fine. That's
good.
So hold on. You're telling me we have to get rid of corrupt Republicans and some corrupt Democrats? Oh, my gosh. Well, that's what Republicans presented that as though like that would be a good reason that we all should just let's just call this quits. Let's get rid of all the corrupt people on either side.
Yeah. No. So two things to that. Right. Number one, I mean, I've been a huge Hillary Clinton defender. Right. If The evidence came out tomorrow that Hillary Clinton laundered money the way Paul. Yeah, Lynn, lock her up. Right. I'm totally with you. And number two, it kind of reminded me of the trial balloon. We commented on a past OA that Trump advanced that he was going to pardon Rod Blagojevich. And, you know, and we just sort of sat there and scratched our heads. Yeah. And we're like, does he think that that's going to work? That like that Democrats are clamoring, you know, to get Blaga? Like, are you?
Yeah, like we'll be like, Arpaio is pardoned, but also Blagojevich. So I guess we're all happy. Is that what he thinks?
Yeah.
No, they should both be in prison.
Yes, exactly. So there we go. That's the status of how recent developments have affected the Democrats in the midterm elections. And we're going to talk a little bit more about this on Tuesday's episode, because I want to talk about a piece of pending legislation. But I thought this was good to kind of delve into Collins, because he's really out there, you know, trying to litigate this in the court of public opinion. He's doing so in a way that's deceptive.
I feel like
our listeners should know.
Using the Trump playbook, don't you think? It's essentially the collusion is not a crime thing, but like, oh, look, I didn't trade. You know, it's kind of that same thing. Honestly, can you blame him? It seems to have worked for Trump this long, so I guess he thinks that's gonna work with the public. But it's weird because for him it doesn't come down to the public, right? I mean, for Trump it's one thing because it's just can enable Congress to not do anything, but with him, I mean, he's just gonna have a trial, right? And then it's gonna be pretty straightforward.
Yeah, he's been indicted, right? But he is running. I mean, this is maybe I should have led with this. He's running for re-election, right? Like he's not stepping down.
I see. I was wondering.
He's vowing to fight. You know this? Okay. Yeah. Sorry. That I suppose that would have been a useful predicate to put in there, right? No, he's claiming that he's gonna go to the mat. Paul Ryan has suspended him from his committee assignments. So, you know, unlike Trump, there's no circling the wagons for Chris Collins, Republican backbencher from upstate New York. And you're getting hung out to dry, buddy.
Gotcha. All right.
The asbestos industry is able to thrive in Russia because very little attention is given to human rights or civil rights. Putin really basically runs the show. One might ask, what is the future of asbestos production and use? As long as there's profit to be made and officials to be bribed, this will continue. But if you can't control asbestos, the most notorious industrial carcinogen known, what can you control?
All right, time for, again, what I hope is a historical segment, deep dive. Where are we setting our time machine dial to, Andrew Torres?
We're setting our time machine all the way back to June 1st, 2018. Mm. Yeah. No, the United States Environmental Protection Agency just released a new rule that governs efforts to use asbestos in manufacturing. And this is the subject of considerable back and forth between Democrats and Republicans. The EPA has vociferously denied that it is trying to permit new uses of asbestos, and I want to break that down. Spoiler: the EPA is lying, and I will demonstrate that. But this really does require a lot to unpack, and it has a moment in it. I believe we're going to use this as the show graphic that you will not believe until you see it. It's astonishing to me. So you ready?
I can't wait.
All right. So I lied a little bit because I wanted to do for effect to say that the rule came out in June 1st of 2018. But to understand asbestos, we have to go back to opening arguments.
You know,
favorite president, Richard Nixon.
This is why, you know, we're professional podcasters. You know, I was worried that joke would not work for that reason. And then you came and you saved me. So thanks, partner.
Yep. Yeah. So we are going to time travel all the way back to 1971 to opening arguments, favorite president, Richard Nixon. and the President's Council on Environmental Quality, which issued a report calling for comprehensive federal legislation to control hazardous chemicals. So in the early 1970s is right about the time when that entered the public consciousness. And Richard Nixon said, we should do something about that. I know, shocking. It took 5 years to get legislation through. Again, it took to Republican President Gerald Ford to pass a bill, the Toxic Substances Control Act, or TSCA. That today is codified at 15 U.S.C. Section 2601 and following. I need to say this. The TSCA is not perfect legislation. It is ambiguous in places. And due to the battle between industry and environmental protection groups being waged between the right and the left starting in the Reagan administration, we've shown that the Nixon and Ford administrations were pretty environmentally friendly by the at least by the standards of Republicans. But that battle really took place on the front lines with Ronald Reagan. And as a result, the TSCA has not been super effective. So, for example, critics of the TSCA pointed out that the way that it was formulated, which requires the EPA to determine that a chemical presents, quote, an unreasonable risk, end quote, of injury to human health or the environment before it can impose controls on that chemical. And then it is empowered, the EPA is then empowered to do anything from require a warning label all the way up to banning the use of that chemical. And so critics have pointed out that because it put the burden on the EPA, that really led to very few regulations under this act. And in fact, of 82,000 chemicals that were submitted to the EPA, the EPA is only required testing for 200 and has only required has only promulgated restrictions on five of those 82,000 chemicals. But one of those five is asbestos. And the reason is that asbestos is unbelievably harmful to human health. Asbestos is a naturally occurring substance that is mined. It is incredibly useful as an insulator, but the process of mining it and using it causes asbestos fibers to become airborne. And once they settle in your lungs, they are not just an irritant, but unbelievably carcinogenic. And, you know, we don't need to get into the history of asbestos litigation in this country. The links there are demonstrable and proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Asbestos is really, 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 really bad for you. I'm kind of shocked that I have to say this on the podcast.
Things we didn't know. You want to tell other things that are bad for us? Smoking? What's next for the for the going out in the sun without sunscreen? No, asbestos equals bad. Okay.
Okay, time to do an ad. This week's episode is brought to you by Beachbody On Demand. Beachbody On Demand is an online portal. You get instant access to their streaming service that gives a wide variety of effective workouts that you can do from the comfort of your own home. Here's how it works. You log in. I do it on my phone. You can then select your difficulty level, the amount of time you have for the workout, what you want to do with that workout, right? Slimming, building your core, building muscle, whatever. And then it filters out and you can choose from among the programs. So I've been doing the 10-minute trainer with Tony Horton. I've been doing that because obviously I'm incredibly busy all the time. But you can make 10 minutes a day to work out. And I've been really happy with the program, really happy with the results. So if you've been thinking about losing weight, maybe try it out with me. And as of right now, listeners to Opening Arguments can get a free trial membership. All you have to do is text OA to 303030. So text OA to 303030. You get free access to the entire platform, all of the workouts, the nutrition information. There are cooking guides. There's support. There's online community. There are like a million people online that all participate in the online community. And you can access all of their workout materials and give it a try. So send out text OA to 303030 and try Beachbody On Demand.
We need to take a quick break to tell you about SaneBox. SaneBox is a product that, I'll be honest, it really speaks to my heart because I get a little obsessive compulsive about my email. I've always wanted to not have a bunch of unread messages that I've ignored. And that, frankly, has become a very, very difficult, if not impossible thing having podcasts and as many podcasts as I do, and as many thoughtful listeners like for Opening Arguments who are sending us cool stuff and questions and all that. It's very difficult to keep up with. Well, SaneBox is here to help. They say they are like EMT for your email. So as messages flow in, SaneBox does the triage for you. It sifts only the important emails to your inbox and directs all other distracting stuff into your Sane Later folder. So you know what messages to pay attention to and what stuff you can get to later on. There are some really cool features that I think are going to help you if you have any issues like this, like I do. There is the Sane Black Hole, and it's kind of what it sounds like. I think this is great because there are so many emails that I get that no matter how many times I try to unsign up for it or say I'm not interested, somehow I keep getting these updates forever. Well, with Sane Black Hole, all you do is drag that email in there, and SaneBox will filter these out and always put them in this Sane Black Hole, meaning you don't have to get this junk mail anymore. It's dealt with. Another one here, Sane Reminders. This reminds you when you need to do a follow-up email, which is super useful for me because if I accidentally mark something as read or I look at it and then I mean to get to it later and then 50 more emails pile in, then I'm never going to remember that I needed to follow up with something. But Sane Reminders is there to help you. Here's the best part. You can use SaneBox with any email client or phone anywhere you check your email. So why don't you see how SaneBox can magically remove distractions from your inbox with a free 2-week trial. Go to SaneBox.com/OA to start your free trial and get a $25 credit. SaneBox.com/OA for Opening Arguments.
Okay, so you've got this TSCA, and it hasn't been super useful. So in 2016, in the waning moments of the Obama administration, Congress actually managed to pass an amendment to the TSCA. Confusingly, it is the Frank Lautenberg, who was then the senator from New Jersey, the Frank Lautenberg Toxic Chemical Safety Act, or TCSA. In any event, the 2016 amendments were designed to put some more teeth into the TSCA. And those provisions, codified at 15 USC 2605 2A, we'll link in the show notes, required initial risk evaluations and subsequent designations of high and low priority substances. So the specific text of the law said, not later than 180 days, 6 months, after June 22nd, 2016, the administrator of the EPA shall ensure that risk evaluations are being conducted on 10 chemical substances drawn from the 2014 update of the TSCA work plan and shall publish the list of those substances. Okay, so it says that's how we're going to get the ball rolling. Instead of just having this vague, there are 82,000 chemicals and you've got to meet, you know, this high burden of proof, pick the 10 worst and start doing the research on it. So they did that. And on December 19th of 2016, the EPA published its list of the 10 chemical substances. That list was, and again, I am not going to do an Andrew was wrong on my mispronunciation of these. It was asbestos and 9 other chemicals. 1 bromopropane, carbon tetrachloride, 1,4-dioxane, cyclic alphatic bromide cluster, abbreviated HBCD for reasons
just
that I have no
reading these
idea.
In case people like are going to, you know, check around you guys, see if you have any of these in your room.
I know we have chemists who listen to the show. So I want to make sure I give a shout out to everybody who's like, oh, yeah, I work with methylene chloride all the time.
Okay.
N-methyl pyrolidone.
You just want more emails, don't you? You just want more emails.
Perchloroethylene, pigment violet 29. So don't own any purple stuff. Pigment violet 29 and trichloroethylene. Anyway, so the Obama EPA in a lame duck session, complying with this requirement, issues that list of the 10 substances. But as you might imagine, I think Frank Lautenberg expected that these amendments were going to be handled by Hillary Clinton's EPA and not by Donald Trump's EPA. Donald Trump's EPA, we've all been through Scott Pruitt. That did not seem to be a mandate of putting strong environmental controls in place. The appointee who oversees the EPA's toxic chemical unit, who is charged with frontline responsibility in making these determinations is a woman named Nancy Beck. And she used to work for, and when I say used to work for, I mean until 2017, worked for an outfit called the American Chemistry Council, which is a lobby on behalf of dangerous chemical manufacturers. They are, in fact, the major, they're the NRA of the chemistry industry, right? And the ACC wrote a letter to the EPA in August of 2016, so right after the Lautenberg Act passed, arguing that they should be able to use asbestos. And that argument was based on the fact that asbestos is also apparently usable in the chlorine industry. I do not begin to understand chemically how this works, but I've read the letter, and so what it says is we no longer produce any asbestos in the United States. We haven't done that since 2002. Put a pin in that one because we're coming back to it. So chlorine manufacturers ought to be able to import asbestos and then use it in this chlorine process. Okay, so they write this letter. And then the person who writes the letter is hired to oversee the EPA, their toxic chemicals unit, evaluating the efficacy of asbestos. And then the EPA, under Beck's supervision, does two things. First, in 2017, as required by the law, they update the methodology for evaluating the harms of the 10 chemicals on the list. And I'm not going to dig into this. I'm going to include the annotated notes and the New York Times article. It is very clear when you read the annotations, when you read the reports, that the methodology chosen by the EPA was designed to produce lower numbers, right? Was designed to make it easier for chemicals to pass the threshold of safe not deleterious to human health. Okay. To put those links together, the New York Times does as good a job as I could do. So go, if you're skeptical on that claim, go read. I'm going to include both the article and the underlying documents, which I have read and put together and I am persuaded by. So that happened in 2017. As a result of the data gathering, we've now taken our time machine all the way up to June 1st, 2018, in which the EPA now releases its new rule regarding asbestos. And again, I want to clarify that under the act, they had the power to ban asbestos, right? They had the power to say, this is deleterious to human health, and we're going to prevent its uses in everything. They had the power to say, we're going to prevent its uses in everything except chlorine production. They didn't do either of those things. Instead, they made a finding that is, this is a really, really technical administrative procedure rule. Okay, it is called the Significant New Use Rule. And let me try and explain what this does, right? So a significant new use rule is when an administrative agency says, this is a practice that is not presently going on. So it's not part of the status quo. It's not causing harm. But we think it might have a threshold of harm. So if you want to do a thing that's covered by this list, then you have to apply to the EPA for permission to do that. And so that's what this did with respect to asbestos. It said asbestos is no longer being used in these 24 industries. Why is it no longer being used in those 24 industries? Because it's obviously toxic to human health, and almost all of those industries have been sued into oblivion. And in fact, you know, not only, I mean, the company that was essentially amalgamated asbestos, Significant New Use Rule, SNUR, says asbestos is not being used in these industries and for these purposes, right? Including insulation and roofing tiles and all the things that, of course, led to the explosion of asbestos litigation from the 1970s to today. And let me be 100% clear about that. The company that was essentially Amalgamated Asbestos Corp, right, like the primary manufacturer of asbestos in the United States, was a company called Johns Manville. They no longer exist. All of the assets of the old Johns Manville Corporation have been placed into trust and are being doled out over time to asbestos victims. And in fact, this is oversimplifying the history of asbestos litigation by a lot. But essentially, once the link to asbestos was proven in court...
And then once Chris Collins sold all his stock in... in that company.
Right. Yeah. The Johns Manville company essentially said, oh, well, okay, that's it. We're going to voluntarily put our assets into a trust. We get the fact that that we're going down. So everybody who manufactured asbestos went into bankruptcy. Their assets are either dispersed or in trust. Everybody who used asbestos in any product, right? People who sold asbestos roofing tiles, for example, all those people are in bankruptcy and have had their assets. And in fact, for the past 20 to 30 years, most of the asbestos litigation in this country has been on tertiary providers, right? That is like shipyards where people used asbestos in insulation around a boiler, right, to prevent the boiler from getting too hot. So, you know, we've gone from manufacturer to manufacturer of product containing asbestos to job sites that used a product that was manufactured containing asbestos. Billions of dollars were litigated over asbestos. I mean, you know, huge, huge sums. So it's not surprising that those industries are no longer uses. But what the EPA didn't do was say, and they should remain prohibited uses, right? Let me be clear on the remain. Under the TSCA, it is true, because this is an aspect of the EPA's disingenuous defense. It is true that there was not an outright prohibition on asbestos. And the reason for that is because the EPA prohibited it in 1991, and that was overturned by a very complicated court decision that said, under the old TSCA, you don't have the authority to prohibit the use of asbestos. That's part of why they amended the law, right? So it was not prohibited, but it has been the longstanding sense of the EPA that it ought to be, and the act was clearly passed with that in mind, and there's no doubt in my mind that a Hillary Clinton EPA would have said, yeah, no, look, obviously it's asbestos. We're going to, right? The Trump EPA did not do that. Instead, what they said was for these 20 different categories of asbestos use, you can apply to the EPA and you have to receive EPA approval before you start or resume the manufacturing or importing or processing of asbestos in connection with these uses.
Is there a briefcase full of cash requirement part to that too, or is that just implied?
Hilariously, there is. So you do have to, when you apply to the EPA for this significant new use notice, you have to pay for the fact that you're causing government work time, right? But they lowered the price on what it costs to apply to, in some cases, $100.
Wow.
But yeah, so yes, you have to pay for the application, but they made it cheaper to pay for the application. And in the SNUR, they included adhesives, sealants, roof coatings, arc chutes, beater ad gaskets, extruded sealant tape and other tape, all the kinds of stuff that resulted in asbestos litigation in the 1970s to the present. So that got leaked, and this has been a bit of public controversy. And so the EPA has released a statement, and the EPA statement is amazing. I'm going to read some of it. It is dishonest. It is dissembling. That's not what's amazing to me, because, you know, obviously the EPA had a mandate.
EPA
obviously
watchdog.
The EPA in needs a watchdog. The EPA, very clearly, in my view, loosened the regulations and left open the possibility that in the future it may approve asbestos manufacturing in the United States with respect to these particular categories. And so I'm not surprised that some of these answers are dishonest, right? So, for example, it says there's a little Q&A sheet. I'm going to link this in the show notes. And the first question I want to draw your attention to, it's like number three on the list, is, did the Obama administration have the opportunity to propose to restrict new uses of asbestos? And did they propose any action? And then it says, yes, they had the opportunity to propose restrictions on new uses. And no, they did not propose any action. Well, that's a lie. That is unbelievably dishonest. We went through the timeline. The act specifically gave them 6 months to come up with the list of the chemicals. They came up with the list of chemicals in 5 months and started the process. And then the government changed hands. So not true. The every indication is that the Obama administration and the Clinton administration following it would have carried through on banning asbestos. But you know, that's garden variety dissembling. Is asbestos banned today? No, the EPA says. Currently, asbestos is used for a handful of uses, including water purification. The uses are identified in the EPA's problem formulation for asbestos. And then there's the question that prompted this becoming the main segment for today's episode. Does the EPA allow the importation of asbestos from Russia? And what the EPA says is, the EPA cannot simply ban imports, regardless of their source, for current uses unless its ongoing evaluation under the Toxic Substances Control Act identifies unreasonable risk associated with such importation. The SNUR, when final, would prevent import, including from Russia and anywhere else, for the uses in the rule.
What? So this now, was their like frequently asked you, question, and they just said like,
yeah, and go ahead.
Well, I'm just confused. Yeah, like what prompted that? Are they're just getting out ahead of that one? I don't get it.
Yeah, I didn't get it either. So I started looking up the manufacture and importation of asbestos. Remember that pin I told you to put in?
Sure.
Asbestos has not been mined in the U.S. since 2002. And the reason for that is mining asbestos kills asbestos miners, right? Wow. Like that, there is no safe way to mine asbestos because the whole harm of asbestos is that it frays and the fibers get into your lungs. And so obviously any mining process is going to jar enough asbestos that the fibers are going to be out there. From 2002 to 2016, there were two countries in the world that still mined asbestos. And there was one that sold asbestos in the United States. That country was Brazil. That was the supplier for our asbestos for the very limited chlorine industry that we talked about. So in order to use asbestos in the chlorine industry, you have to import it from somewhere. Brazil was the place, and that's where we got our asbestos. But Brazil is undergoing legislative reform to outlaw the mining of asbestos in Brazil, which, by the way, is a fantastically good idea,
yeah,
right?
Like, yeah,
that is a remnant of colonialism.
I was
going to
say, I mean, I'm very uncomfortable with the fact that we're like, well, this is the worst and we can't do it. But if any other country wants to ruin the lives of miners, you know, we'll profit off of that.
So Brazil's going to stop doing that. That leaves one nation in the world that mines and exports asbestos. And that nation...
Australia.
Is Russia.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that nation is Russia. And in fact, the largest asbestos mining company in Russia is a company called Ural Asbest. They have shipped hundreds of tons of asbestos globally. They are the sole exporter of asbestos once Brazil shuts down its asbestos mines. I promise to pay off, it has been reported. I have a copy of the photo at Ural Asbest that shows pallets, okay, wooden pallets that are shrink-wrapped, And on the shrink wrap is a picture, is a seal, right? That pictures Imperial smug Donald Trump with, in Russian, the words approved by U.S. President Donald Trump on this pallet of asbestos. It's astonishing to me, right? Like, if you told me when we were going to begin this segment that this led to the United States allowing potentially the importation of dangerous substances from a hostile foreign power, I would have said, oh, you know, get out of here with your Occupy Democrat stuff, right? But that is where this leads. This leads to a pathway for the EPA under Donald Trump to approve businesses to use asbestos in ways that are toxic to humans and to source that asbestos from Russia, because that's the only place you can get this from. And the proof of that is we have seen pallets that awfully that sure look like they are being prepared to be shipped to the United States. I can't wait for you to see this photo.
Oh, well, I saw it, and I saw somebody sharing a Snopes thing that was like, no, this is actually real. And I was, you know, because it is the kind of thing that you would think was liberal fake news, but nope.
Yep. And that picture of Donald Trump is everything I would expect the Russians to want. I mean, like, it just looks like, you know, but I mean, to me, anyway, that's obviously a sidebar. Donald Trump has long been hostile to prohibitions on asbestos. So in his 1997 book, The Art of the Comeback, he said that anti-asbestos
he predicted
efforts
asbestos
were, quote,
would make a comeback. Ah, it's gotten
mob.
A bad, it's got a bum rap. It's, yeah. You know.
He said that the mob is behind anti-asbestos efforts because they did all the remediation. And you can imagine, right, somebody whose life was spent in real estate holding a grudge over having to remediate asbestos out of his asbestos-filled buildings. There was a long history of Donald Trump on the record being skeptical of asbestos and saying, oh, this is all just a ploy to get the little guy who just happens to own, you know, billions of dollars worth of buildings. So there you have it. The EPA is weakening the standards on asbestos from where we ought to have projected the trajectory to be. The evidence is very, very clear. They are dissembling and saying, no, look, we're promoting new regulations. But they're promoting new regulations that are designed to leave a loophole. And terrifyingly, that loophole involves the importation of asbestos from Russia, which just kind of blows my mind.
Wow. Unbelievable. I mean, I guess so. How many people are going to get cancer from this? I mean, is it still being used in just the like couple uses that seem to be safe? Or do you think they're expanding the uses to things that are going to be unsafe for us? How concerned should we be?
Yeah. So let's be clear. This is the first step, right? Right now, under the SNUR, there are no new uses that are approved automatically. However, there is the categories that we described for which you may now apply to the EPA, and the EPA has the discretion to decide whether to grant you the approval to go ahead and start manufacturing products in those industries that contain asbestos. So right now, nothing, right? Right now, nothing has changed. But what has changed is the infrastructure, the groundwork. And by the way, the person who's in charge of deciding whether you get approval under the SNUR is somebody who has lobbied on behalf of asbestos for 20 years. So, you know, that's right now, does it lead to anything? No, but that's why we want to shine sunlight on this, right? That's why it's a great thing that folks are out there and commenting on it. And it's why I wanted to comment on this, you know, otherwise sort of seemingly benign, very, very difficult to parse rule that on its face, it's super easy to look at it and go, okay, they're announcing new restrictions on asbestos. Isn't that good? And it's why I wanted to walk through what all of that meant.
All right. Well, yeah, I think it's amazing. It's when you hand over the EPA to a villain from one of those cartoons that I saw in the 90s that I don't remember, where it was always the anti-environment people.
Captain Planet. Right?
Yeah, well, I think Captain Planet was a little earlier, but I think there were a bunch of knockoffs by the time I was a kid where it's, you know, the villain was always somebody who, like, just for fun, wanted to, like, dump a bunch of oil in the ocean or something. Like, it was always a weird motivation. I don't know what motive, but it turns out that's real, and now they run the EPA. So,
yep. Yes, they do.
All right.
So there you have it.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions. What?
All right, and we've got a listener question from Matt Baron Q. That's a interesting. Oh no, Matt Baron.
No,
I'm sorry.
No, it's just Q. It's just Matt Baron.
Damn it! I just gave Ryan some good blackmail material. We've got a. I think it was because in my mind I was thinking Sasha
was like
Baron Cohen, and so when I read Matt Baron and saw Q like question, I was just like, naturally my brain went into that mode. Anyway,
I honestly couldn't tell if that was like Norm MacDonald dry wit trying to get out of your, like, from Matt.
No,
Baron,
that was just
Q,
my brain went in the groove of Sasha Baron awesome. Cohen in the terms of syllables. So I just thought, like, yeah, Matt Baron Q. Anyway, so Matt Baron asks us this Q, the following Q. Suppose independent evidence was discovered and charges were filed against an individual who previously received use immunity. It's probably unlikely, but suppose she also testifies in this new case against her. If her testimony conflicts with her earlier testimony, can the previous testimony be introduced against her? Could this conflicting testimony be used in the earlier case as grounds for an appeal? So really a convoluted kind of technical question there. What do you say?
Yeah, there's so much that I want to dive in there, right? So I want to dive into, you know, in what circumstances can the prosecution, can the U.S. government appeal a not guilty verdict in a criminal case, right? Like, that's really rife for us to discuss on the show. What's the difference between use immunity and transactional immunity? That's another great area for us to go to. But we don't have time to do any of that. So so we're going
to cover
it.
Someone had to talk about asbestos. So
yeah, sorry. But I can give you a little bit of teaser. So Matt sent this question before the kind of denouement of the Paul Manafort trial, which is Rick Gates's testimony and cross-examination. And the Manafort strategy on cross-examination of Rick Gates was to accuse him of perjury and suggest that he violated the terms of his plea deal. And the cross-examination testimony involved the number of affairs that he had disclosed to Mueller's team. Right. Turns out 4, because Mueller's team introduced the evidence that, you know, he was off having these affairs. And when he embezzled money from Manafort, that's what he spent the money on. So, you know, we've talked about front loading witnesses and talking about all the bad stuff. The Manafort's team on cross-examination said, did you disclose all 4 of your affairs to the government? And Gates said no. And so then the argument is, oh, well, so you've perjured yourself and the government can revoke your plea deal and they can charge you with perjury and all of that other stuff. So it kind of matches up pretty well with the fact pattern here. I will say this. There is zero doubt in my mind that the government is not going to revoke Rick Gates's plea deal over whether he said he had 3 affairs or 4. This is entirely a smokescreen. This is like, look, this is the kind of thing that defense lawyers do. You use whatever you can to try and discredit a witness, to try and impeach their testimony. But to take somebody who admits to having an affair and admits to embezzlement on on direct, and then on cross-examination being like, yeah, but did you admit to this other? Well, no, I didn't. Right? Like, I do not believe, again, not a criminal guy, but somebody with experience with juries, no jury is going to go, well, I was thinking about believing Rick Gates when he had 3 affairs, but now that he had 4 and didn't, you know, I don't know. Right? Like, that's it. It is that's not going anywhere.
First three affairs, I mean, that's Manafort. anybody's yeah. fine. But the fourth one, that's too far.
Everybody knows.
Yeah. you get three free punch card, and then the fourth one, yeah, no.
Yeah. The Rick Gates punch card. Somebody right now, one of our listeners, is making up a Rick Gates get out of jail free card. No, so this is a pretty standard. I mean, you know, I'm not going to say it's, I'm not going to argue against it, right? And we've said, you know, Manafort has competent counsel. They are doing the best they can under their circumstances, which are not good. Case against Manafort looks really, really strong right now. And so that's the overlap between this question and Yodel Mountain. And then as for the rest of the stuff, we're going to have to get to it in a future episode, man. But keep listening because we are going to get there.
All right. Well, that was good. I mean, you managed to not answer the question, but talk about interesting, relevant stuff. So that works for me. And now we've got to thank our top patrons, our Hall of Famers.
Yeah, thank you. These are all of our Hall of Fame patrons. If you want a weekly shout out, then head on over to patreon.com/law. Pledge as little as $5 an episode. And once you're a month in, we will add you to our Hall of Fame roster and you get to participate in all of this fun. With that in mind, thanks to Trump is definitely willing to throw his own children under the Mueller bus.
Yeah.
Rob Schreck. Matthew Vernon, Mike the Intactivist, let this radicalize you rather than lead you to despair. Good advice. This Week in News with Kevin and Benedict. Poseidon is 9/10 of maritime law. That's a great one.
I still love that one.
Heaney Majeski, Johnny G, Eddie Juice, Johnny Pesky, Thornton Lee. Nice collection of baseball players there. No associate of this firm has ever failed the bra exam. I'm hoping that's intentional and not a typo. The Getting Off Podcast, our friends over there. Great show. That last Patreon patronizes Burger King. Boo. Anonymous. WordOrigins.org, your guide to legal terms from 13th century Saxony. I'm French. Why do you think I have this outrageous accent? If you or a loved one has ever been diagnosed with mesothelioma, you may. Oh my gosh. How appropriate is that for this episode? Big Easy Blasphemy. Serious shoeshine arguments in space. But lady, I'm flying a spaceship. If I shave my eyebrows, will it make my alternate timeline goatee? Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense. Join your labor union, notus gratis, POTUS choose us bogus, SCOTUS Z. Greg Sullivan. Ron to the local milk person. I have a local milk person. Dairy milk is awesome. I haven't been able to drink milk in like a year because of the low carb thing, but man, dairy milk is great. Alex Jones, bath salt supermodel. I misspoke. I meant to say best, not first patron. Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. The Wayward Willis Podcast. Philip Stromberg. Buttercup the Law Cat likes her tuna microwaved for exactly 14 seconds. I will concede microwaving inedible cat food is an okay use of your microwave. Hot spots on my dog. CampQuest.org, CampQuest.org, CampQuest.org. Nothing worse than a monster who thinks he's right with God. Oh, yeah, thanks for bringing us down on that one. Healing Elementals on Etsy, promo code OpenArgs for 10% off. Yeah, so head on over to Etsy. Legalize the Purge. Ah, bringing back a classic. Demolition Man for Lamb. No, look, we just finished Lamb. We're done with good movies. We need, it's in the title, Laud. Awful
I feel like we
movies,
could,
right?
we can't definitely do Demolition Man.
Yeah, no way. Sweet Meteor Death for President 2018. Not sure what country is having a presidential election in 2018, but we could do that. A String of Unpronounceable Characters and Malaika Chandler.
All right. Thank you, Soul. Keith Davies. Andrew is the is the Mick DLT of legal podcast hosts, keeping the hot side hot. What? Willing to donate my young, healthy organs to Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Oh my God! Let's stay on the line. Let's make that work.
Yeah.
I just pretend Andrew is whispering sweet nothings into my ears, don't we all? Jim Grove, cooking Heath with ramen. Blasto and Phoebe are part of the cutest timeline. Protect us from true. I don't know what that is, but it started off great. Man, I'm sad these are getting cut off. Ian and Ally, PivotalSolutionsConsulting.com. Cynthia Francis, Secular Saint, Eli Bosnick, Happy Hour Limbo Contest at the Lakumi Bar, Sam Danau, Stan Bush says, I've got the touch. Is that a reference I don't get?
That is a classic Transformers reference. Oh, okay. Stan Bush did the songs for the 1986 animated Transformers movie, which are amazing.
I'm sorry I asked.
Keep going.
Just kidding. Can
you ask more?
I misspoke. I meant to say criminalize the Purge. Milo Meadsong, the Halfling Bard, and SIU-3L. Hopefully I pronounced that stuff right. I'm Andrew. The only thing I love more than grunge is the Cranberries. Damn it.
That was meant for you. Thank you so much for not giving me this halftime.
Darn it. Soggy Pants. Brian Upshaw's Last Chance for Profit Prison. The 17 Angry Democrats. We are so angry with your success. Yeah, that's what Trump thinks that people will think. 4 of 20, tertiary adjunct of Unimatrix 69. Another Two Live Crew reference. Your mama ain't a patron. Aaron Grady, after Shush 188, Thomas can't criticize Andrew on music anymore. I don't know what that means, but people will have to check out Comedy Shushine 188, I guess. This episode sponsored by McDowell's, home of the Big Mick. Jeremiah's fancy microwaves are not for reheating cheeseburgers. Dave, living life Yodel Mountain High in Trump's America. Mitchell, 3D print super soakers instead. Oh, good idea. Why didn't anybody think of that? Somebody published that plan. I'm lame and just learned name changes are only on the desktop site. Okay. Give Lydia a segment like Lucinda has on Scathing. There we go. Climbing Yodel Mountain this weekend. I'll let you know if I find the top. Ryan Byrne, sandpaper, make slippery slopes safe again. Conrad, and finally, our top patron forever. It's going to be hard for anyone to beat this patron anytime soon, but, you know, you should all try. Conrad Michaels, thank you so much.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, it's TTTBE time. Yeah, I feel like I luckily got one right. I'm on a little bit of a streak.
Yeah, you're on a little bit of a streak. You are 49 for 87. So not only can you get to 60, right, with 11 out of the next 13 correct, but if you get this one correct, you will assure yourself of at least breaking even.
Oh, yeah. The first 100 questions. So if I just fall over, like on the way to the end zone, even if no matter what, I'll have 50. Yeah. I like it.
Yeah. This is the Leon Lett, right? Don't let somebody punch the ball out.
Well, I love the idiots who start celebrating slightly early and just drop the football right at the, you know, 2-inch line. That's happened like 2 times in the last few years.
Don't do that either.
Right. No, I'm going to act like I've been to the bar exam before or something.
There you go. Yeah. Act like you've been admitted to the bar before. All right. I have another contracts question for you.
Okay.
So I'm doing my very best to get you over that finish line.
Look, I don't want any help. I don't want your help. I demand to be taken seriously as a lawyer.
I lied. This is just the next question in the book.
I want to make clear. There's no, you know, you're not, what's the phrase I'm looking for? You're not putting your hand, tipping the scale.
Cherry picking. Yeah, no, absolutely. Right. Like this is just the next question in the book. So
let's do it.
There's no thumb on the scale. There's no cherry picking. Here you go. On January 5th, a creditor loaned $1,000 to a debtor under a contract calling for the debtor to repay the loan at a rate of $100 per month, payable on the first day of each month. On February 1, at the debtor's request, the creditor agreed to permit payment on February 5. On March 1, the debtor requested a similar time extension, and the creditor replied, "Don't bother me each month. Just change the date of the payment to the 5th of the month. But you must now make payments by cashier's check." The debtor said, "Okay," and made payments on March 5th and April 5th by cashier's check. On April 6th, the creditor sold the loan contract to a bank, but did not tell the bank about the agreement permitting payments on the 5th of the month. On April 6th, the bank wrote to the debtor, "Your debt to the creditor has been assigned to us. We hereby inform you that all payments must be made on the first day of the month." Okay, so bit of a complicated fact pattern there, but
interesting.
Now the question. Can the debtor justifiably insist that the payment date for the rest of the installments is the 5th of each month? A. No, because a contract modification is not binding on an assignee who has no knowledge of the modification. B. No, because although the creditor waived the condition of payment on the first of the month, the bank reinstated it. C, Yes, because although the creditor waived the condition of payment on the first of the month, the creditor could not assign to the bank his right to reinstate that condition. Where D, yes, because the creditor could assign to the bank only those rights the creditor had in the contract at the time of the assignment.
Oh, wow. This is, I guess be careful what you wish for, because I thought I was pretty good at contracts, but this is a very tricky one. So it sounds like, I mean, they essentially agreed to change the date to the 5th, it sounds like, and then the creditor sold the contract to a bank and didn't tell them about the fact that they had changed it to the 5th. And so, yeah, I mean, it's a question that makes a lot of sense. Seems like something, you know, that might happen in the world, but I feel like every answer pretty much is reasonable. So this is going to be a hard one. So I think what's interesting to me in this is oftentimes I have to, like, you know, use the answers to kind of learn and try to figure it out. And the language of, like, waiving the condition of payment is interesting versus modifying the contract. Now, I feel like those are two different things. Maybe I'll end up being wrong, but I feel like that kind of matters, because if they just modified the contract, so changed the date of payment to the 5th. See, that sounds like modifying the contract to me rather than waiving the condition of payment. Hopefully that's not just something I'm reading too much into, but that was my impression, because if you just waive the condition of payment, that sounds to me like it could be due anytime, not like, oh, change this to the 5th. You know what I mean? So I'm going to hope, you know, I'm just going to have to hope that's something. Maybe it's not. So I think that would maybe eliminate B and C, even though those seem like reasonable answers. So this could be totally me losing it here. And maybe this is me fumbling all the way, just rattle off 13 incorrect answers in a row and get 49 out of 100. So B, no, because although the creditor waived the condition of payment on the first of the month, the bank reinstated it. See, I think that's reasonable, except I don't think the creditor waived that condition. Well, unless that's the effectively what happened, because they didn't, like, change the writing in the contract. So maybe that's why that's that way, but I don't know. C, yes, because although the creditor waived the condition of payment on the first of the month, the creditor could not assign to the bank his right to reinstate that condition. And D, yes, because the creditor could assign to the bank only those rights the creditor had in the contract at the time of assignment. So, you know, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to hope that whatever I just said is right. It might not be. I'm going to eliminate B and C, because I think the creditor didn't waive anything. I think that what effectively happened is they changed the contract to the 5th of the month, and it didn't get written down or whatever. But now the question is, well, if that's the case, does that transfer to the bank or not? And I'm going to go with the reasonableness thing, and I'm just going to hope that, reasonably speaking, if they had changed the contract but hadn't written it down, that when someone sold the contract, they should still have those rights. So I'm going to go with D. Yes, because the creditor could assign to the bank only those rights the creditor had in the contract at the time of assignment. So my thinking is, the contract got changed, and the debtor can insist that the payment date be the 5th, because that's what it was in the new contract. And the wording of D is essentially, yeah, the bank can't just invent this right that it had because the contract's been changed. So eliminating B and C, it was between A and D, going with D. Hopefully that made any sense.
Wow. So, boy, you worked through an awful lot of very detailed legal analysis. I can't tell you whether it was right, but I can
yeah,
say...
Yeah, I can't wait for the next week will be like, what is it, Billy Madison or something, where he gives this long answer, yeah, and he's like, we're all stupider for having heard it. So I see. So your relationship with the 90s is puzzling to me. So you reject our music. But you're happy with our Adam Sandler movies? What is? Okay, no, never mind. I'm not.
It is cultural appropriation of that quote.
take all of us or leave all of us. I'm speaking for the 90s. Okay, all right. Well, yeah, I can't wait to find out if that pile of mumbo jumbo that I just spouted is right or wrong. And thanks so much to everybody who plays. You know how to do it. You share the show and you do the whole thing and do an answer, and then people see it, and it's fun. And that being said, we'll have to see you guys on Tuesday. We got an action-packed episode for you, and we can't wait.
Yep, until then.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.